Welcome to Rule Breakers for Gender Equality. My name is Nancy Polian, and I'm on a mission to make the top of the business world more diverse and inclusive. Because to me, rule breaking is all about taking a risk. The risk to be yourself and to create your own career path. In 2021, there were more CEOs named Peter than women CEOs in the Netherlands. This is one of the rules that I want to break. Let's see which business leader is breaking the rules today. I'm here today with one of the biggest rule breakers that I know. Miss. Is it Miss? Can I say Miss?
You can say Miss.
Even though, you know, probably other people wouldn't think that you were Miss anymore. And I keep thinking about this interview that I once saw of Maya Angelou correcting a woman who said, I want to ask Maya. And then she said, it's Miss Angelou for you.
Janet.
Okay. Kim Fukui.
Yes.
I'm so happy that you're here today. I love sharing your story. I always use you as an example when I talk to women and I, you know, dare them to challenge themselves, to think differently. So I'm very honored that you're here. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor and a privilege.
Fancy. Yeah. And we're going to talk about so many different things, but the biggest subject is how you can rock your career even after 50. Because I want these youngsters to know it never ends.
It's not over when you turn 50. It's just starting,
it's
actually.
It's just starting. And it just started for you as well. But before we get into that, tell me about yourself. Where are you from? Were your parents? I mean, you're obviously not Dutch. So
no,
we want to know the story of how you got here, basically.
Yes. So I'm very American.
Yes.
I grew up in Chicago. On the South Side.
Like Barack?
Like
and
Michelle Obama.
Michelle did.
Yeah, because right. Barack grew up in Hawaii.
Hawaii, yeah.
And other places, Indonesia.
I keep thinking about that movie of them together, South Side.
Yeah!
Yes.
That's exactly the same place.
You're
actually,
right. It's Michelle.
Michelle and I went to the same school, but at different times, because she's a little bit older than me. And I am the daughter of two parents who grew up in the South. So I'm a product of people who moved and migrated from a very segregated southern state called Alabama. And they decided to move themselves to Chicago and start a whole new life and a whole new family.
Because there was a whole migration that happened.
It was the Great Migration.
60s, right?
Correct. The Great Migration of the 60s, where a lot of African Americans at that time were dealing with so much segregation, so much discrimination, that it limited their opportunities. So they decided, hey, let's go to the North because there's less there. Not that it did not exist in the North, still existed there, but they had a lot more opportunities. And my dad actually got drafted because it was Vietnam era time. And so he got drafted, but then he was able to take advantage of the GI Bill. So he went into the Army. He had already met my mom, married my mom, but I was born shortly after they were married. And then we moved to Germany, and I lived there for 2.5 years. But then they came back to Chicago, and my dad had the GI Bill where he was able to get his degree in accounting at University of Illinois.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And were they involved in the civil rights movement?
Yes. So actually, it was interesting. My mom, speaking of powerful women, my mom was the one that was really the one that was involved in the civil rights movement because she grew up in Montgomery. And she grew up, she was 8 years old at the time of the Montgomery boycott.
The bus boycott,
the one that Rosa Parks ignited with her not sitting in the back of the bus. And she remembers that time. She remembers doing the carpooling, the taxis, how
Let's
people
Let's just give
in churches.
People some context because some people might not know about this. So
yeah.
Rosa Parks, so this is when Montgomery had segregation and you, as a black person, you had to go in the back of the bus and sit down.
Correct.
But Rosa Parks got on a bus one day and the back rows was filled. It was filled. Everybody was seating and she went and sat on a free seat up front and they asked her to get up because it was reserved for white people and she wouldn't get up. And this started a whole boycott of black people in Montgomery basically for a year and a half.
Yes.
They didn't go to...
They didn't use public transportation.
They just walked and carpool.
Yeah,
carpool.
Mm-hmm.
And your parents, your mother was part of
My
that.
My mother was a part of that. And she remembers the marches because all during that time, this is not talked about as much, but all during that time, there's also other protests. you know, America and many other Western countries, protests was allowed, even though it was limited in the South. So she was a part of that, she and her family. And she actually went to church with Fred Gray, who was one of Martin Luther King's attorneys. So he was one of the major attorneys involved in the civil rights movement. And yeah, she grew up with these people. She went to school with these people. They taught her. She went to church with them.
So what was it like to have a mother like that, who obviously knew what injustice meant, and then wanting to give you all of the opportunities that she could give anybody, you know, that
and
you could have?
I really think that's why my parents were so bold, because as I tell the story, you know, we grew up in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago, which was a predominantly Black area at that time. But my parents had a vision of us getting the best education that they could provide, public education that they could provide. And at that time in the Chicago area, it was about where you lived. So they worked really hard to get us to the suburbs of Chicago, which is where some of the best public education was provided.
And I'm to get a house there.
They got a house there. They purchased a home there. So we moved from the south side of Chicago,
which is all Black.
All Black.
To a white neighborhood.
To all white. Mm. I mean, it was so all white. It was less than 1% non-white. Mm. So that included everybody that was non-white. Mm. You know, Chinese,
Latinas,
Latinx, Black folks, everybody. And in my school, there were 3,000 kids, my high school, because by that time it was time for me to go to high school. There were 3,000 students there, and there were only 10 Black people out of the 3,000 from all over the city. And it was the largest high school in the city. But I'm saying that to say that my mom and dad, I think really driven by my mom, were so brave. Because can you imagine growing up, being told you can't even look white people in the face when you're walking down the street, you can't swim in the same swimming pools, you can't
live with them.
And then you go and you're the only black family
that could have been scary
in that neighborhood and surrounded by people that look like the people that oppressed you pretty much your entire life.
So what did that do to you, though, as a Black girl coming from an elementary school that was probably all Black to a high school, going to a high school that's all white?
Yeah, it was tough. It was really difficult.
Did you get teased?
Oh yeah, people tease me about my hair, because you know you get your hair washed, and I don't know if you had this, Nancy, but your mom would oil your scalp. Mm-hmm. You know,
of course, got to take care of your scalp.
Yeah, exactly. So I would get teased maybe about how my hair oil smelled in my hair. I would get teased about the color of my skin. People would use the N-word. That would happen. And many people thought that when I said I came from Chicago, all they knew of Chicago were the projects. Yeah. If you think about Cabrini Green, or if anybody's ever watched reruns of a U.S. show called Good Times, if anybody remembers that.
That's they never what got they, it here.
Yeah, okay, you guys didn't get that. But they envisioned this kind of very tall, high-rise, you know, little tiny apartments. And they saw that as less than, right? You're coming from a ghetto area, and we're allowing you the privilege as special Black people to live with us. When in fact, first of all, I never lived in a project, never lived in a ghetto. There were very nice homes in the Chicago, inner city of Chicago. And we moved from a nice home to an even nicer home in Naperville, larger home. But it was, you know, we were seen as ghetto kids just because of the color of our skin.
That. How did you do that? So if you look back on those days, you can analyze it now because you're 50 plus. You can look at it. You know about your emotions. You know about what they had and what they felt and why they did what they did.
Yeah.
What do you think made you not even survive but even thrive after that?
Yeah, I believe definitely I would attribute it to my parents. I would attribute it to my parents and my family and my friends in general, because my parents never let us back down. They always supported us, especially if we were defending ourselves. So if we were defending ourselves against that kind of, discrimination or name calling. And they also, I would say they also really pushed us to think about education. So they're like, people can call you whatever they want, but they can't take good grades away from you. Mm-hmm. They can't take a degree away from you. You go to college and get your degree.
So you focused on that.
We focused on education.
Did you make any friends when you were in high school?
Yeah. There were some good people. There's never, typically in areas like that, there's never there's at least one person that is willing to be your friend and be different. Because there were people there that were also different, right? There mm-hmm. were people there who had disabilities or other Black people, of course. We actually formed a group called Family Affair. And that Family Affair was a group of Black families, the few that lived in Naperville. And we went on trips together. We did parties together. So we had formed our own support group. Kind of grassroots, like it wasn't any national group.
This is what I tell women to do all the time. When you're the only one, find a support group.
Yes.
Or if there's not a support group, start one.
Yes.
Just make sure that you've got people who are holding your back.
Yeah,
so you
and
don't
people
fall.
Who are experiencing what you're experiencing, so you know that you're not alone.
Alone, yeah. Because we oftentimes think that we're alone.
Yeah, isolation and loneliness is a killer. Mm. Yeah, you never want that. So we were surrounded by love. We were surrounded by parents that expected and, pretty much demanded, in a good way, the best. And I also started to notice that many of the people that gave me a hard time, it was because they were comparing themselves to me. And I had a situation where I was accepted to one of the best state schools. It was still a public school. In the state, University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. And I was told that I was only accepted because I was Black. But when I come to find out that the person that said this was not accepted at a really good school.
So somebody lied to you, basically. They said you're accepted because
you're
Black.
Well, they assumed. They made an assumption. So this is one of my fellow students that said, yeah, you were only accepted into that school because you were Black and they had to fulfill a quota.
This is what women hear all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you're only accepted, you got that chief executive role because you're a woman.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're a woman. And then in my case, Black woman, a woman of color. But then I found out that this person did not have their grades weren't as good as mine. Their college entrance exams they had to take was not as good as mine. And so it's a matter of they feel bad about themselves. So let me see if I can make somebody else feel bad so I can feel better. It's a very backwards way of thinking. And then you realize, I remember having these discussions with my dad. He said, look, most of those people who are trying to make you feel inferior, it's because they feel inferior.
So you had those conversations at home.
Home,
and because you were having those conversations, that kind of gave you strength and because you had insights.
Yes.
And you could deal with those things better.
Yeah.
So you went off to college.
Yeah.
And you started, I think you started working at Microsoft quite early on, didn't you?
Yeah.
You've been with Microsoft
for ages.
I was a baby.
I say I was a prodigy, just so people don't start guessing my age when I say I've been there for 25 years. I started quite young. I was in my 20s. And I actually was looking for a public relations position at the time. And I only took the Microsoft role because I was like, okay, I'm going to make some money. I'm going to make some money for my family. I was newly married. I didn't have any babies, no kids. And I was bored. I was a bored housewife. And I couldn't find a position in the area that I wanted, public relations and marketing. So I said, okay, I'll just do this just until I find something better. And then I really liked it. I actually became an HR recruiting assistant, was the name at the time. And I could see, what they were paying people and what kind of roles were coming across the table because I was part of the recruiting team, right? So when I looked at that, I was like, maybe I should consider Microsoft. And many of the qualifications and the responsibilities I had the skills, I could do these things. So why not? And eventually, I had a mentor, even when I was a contractor, and she was a Black woman. She had worked at IBM.
This is important, right? Getting mentors out there.
Yes.
Because a mentor really shows you, they give you advice and they show you how they've done it and what you can learn from them.
And she was more than a mentor. She was a sponsor because she made sure I was one of the interview candidates for the role that I went for.
She opened doors for you.
She opened doors. Absolutely. Yeah. And then once I got the role, I was able to excel in the role. It was a sales role. I was selling what we call enterprise product support. I had some of the largest customers in the East region in the U.S., financial customers.
I did. But you were also visible. You didn't just do the good job.
I didn't just do that.
You went
out
there and...
Yeah.
Was that because of your sponsor? And
I think it was because of my sponsor and because I always feel like giving back as soon as possible is what we should do. And Microsoft has given me a platform to talk about many of the things that we just talked about, how there's been discrimination and there's been, you know, people kind of oppressing you and holding you back as a woman, as a Black person, as a other, you know, but you can see that I'm not held back and I'm not letting that stop me. So I always use that mantra, that idea to help other people and to motivate other people to
and
see.
And that also makes you visible because if you're helping others, you're shining a light on them. It also, again, shines a spotlight on you because you're the person helping them.
And it's not about the spot. I think you actually told me this and I use this all the time, right? If you're in it for service, there's no need to be nervous.
Yeah. If your heart is at service.
If your heart is at service. Okay, so I borrowed that one from, I think,
what's his name again? Lewis House.
Okay. Well, I always tell people that it's not about the spotlight. It's about your mindset. Are you really trying to help people? Because when you're really trying to help people, you will share. You'll share your story. You will share your contacts, your network. You will share ideas and you'll share everything. And that will help people to move on and go and do some, they'll pass it on, right? Mm-hmm. So it becomes it's like a domino effect. And after a while, you probably don't even have to be that visible and you can see the fruits of your labor from what you've done. But I believe in that sharing is caring, truly.
I love the fruits of your labor part because we're coming to that part soon.
Okay.
So you're in the States, you're working for Microsoft, you've got a mentor, you've got a sponsor, you've got people opening doors for you. You even told me a story once about how you were able to get a white male ally.
Yes.
Tell me that story again.
Yeah, so I'll always be grateful to this guy. So actually, I was not supposed to be on his team. And because I had heard such great things about what a great manager he was, I lobbied to get on his team. And I actually had to present myself, what I had done, the things I accomplished, the ideas and the ambition I had at Microsoft, presented to him, ended up on his team. And after about 2.5 years, he had supported me during that time to travel all over South America and Mexico, which is the Microsoft's, what we call our LATAM area or Latin American area.
But you wanted to be on his team.
I wanted to
be
on his team.
Tell me the number one reason. Why? Why was he so special?
Because he was visible and visible advocate and ally for all kinds of people. And it was to the point, Nancy, that it was a daily practice for him. It was not something, you could tell that it wasn't something where he was, you know, trying to be, you know, an ally for our employee resource group, Blacks at Microsoft, because he wanted attention. He did it because he truly believed that a diverse culture is the best culture. A diverse team drives success. And as we know, that's proven through, you know, much research, right? So, and he would stick up for me. You know, if it seemed that I was not, my voice was not being heard, he would purposely, intentionally, Kim, we haven't heard from you.
He would say that during a
meeting. He would say that during a meeting. We need to hear what your thoughts are, what your ideas are. Please share them with
us. That's allyship.
That is allyship in action.
Yeah.
And so he went from that all the way to being willing to sponsor me and help me move over to Europe. Actually, you want to hear that part of the story? Or
yeah,
am I moving too fast?
No, you're not moving fast at all. Go on, girl.
Yeah. Yeah, so after about 2.5 years on his team and supporting many people in Latin America or in South America and Mexico, I decided I wanted to live and work. So work and live in a place other than the U.S., which
but
I had never done.
How, I mean, take us into years because this is like 20 years on.
Or yeah, this is 20 years later and a lot had happened, right? By that time, unfortunately, I had an issue with my marriage and that didn't work out. I'd already had 2 children. My daughter was like 20 so at the time and my son, during the course of this time, he had passed away in 2016. So I lost my 14-year-old son. We woke up one morning and he had already passed away from a seizure in his sleep. So it was quite challenging.
Devastating.
Devastating. Yeah. Yeah. Still is. Still
yeah, tough. I can see that.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think what I decided to do was I had to change. I had to figure out what am I going to do to carry on my life and to keep going and to honor my son in doing that. Right. Because I also think that, you know, he wouldn't want me to be unhappy. He wouldn't want me to be unproductive. He knew how his mom was kind of, I'm kind of a tough lady. I pushed him. I pushed my daughter, who I'm really proud of. She's also getting her master's right now. So I'll say that. Really smart young lady. And so I figured I had to change. I had to make some different decisions. And that's when I started to think about what could I do to grow myself professionally, but also grow personally.
Yeah.
And go to a different place, just change it up. And sometimes we have to think about that, right? It's not, sometimes you get on a path and people will tell you, stay on the path, stay on the road. No, you need to create your own path.
Yeah, and change it.
And change it.
But you came to a country you'd never been to.
That's right.
And it has the most rainy days, I think.
Other than Seattle, which yeah. I've been to a lot too, but...
Oh my God, you came to the Netherlands.
Yeah, what was I thinking? What was I thinking?
No, Microsoft does well over here, right?
Microsoft does well here. It is.
Is it the European headquarters here?
Pretty, yes. I would say that it is. When I say, well, European, Western, we have a Western Europe region, and Microsoft Netherlands is the largest subsidiary of Microsoft within that region.
So yes. You came here.
Yeah.
You got somebody to sponsor you to come here. Was there a job waiting for you?
Yeah. So what happened was, as you mentioned, the white man that was my sponsor, he actually talked to one of his colleagues because he knew that she was looking to start a brand new role at Microsoft that had never existed before. A very senior role within our customer success organization. And we typically start those roles in the U.S., but because we had a customer here that was based in the Netherlands that was really adamant about having the senior level role assigned to them, they said, okay, we'll start it in the Netherlands. And it was a black woman that he connected me with. So, you know, you have a white male connecting me with the black woman who eventually became my sponsor to bring me to the Netherlands.
Wow.
Yeah.
So basically, you just had this dramatic period in your life where yeah. you lost your son.
Yes.
Your marriage fell apart.
Yes.
By yourself, you moved to a different country.
Yeah.
And then on top of things, decided to start a whole new role that never existed before.
Never existed. And there was no guarantee.
And you were over 50.
Yeah, I was 50. Actually, I was
5. Exactly 50.
Exactly 50.
I'm turning 50 this year. So maybe I should be making all these drastic. No, I'm just joking. But listen, you did that. That takes a lot of guts and a lot of courage. So what are we teaching women about this? Yeah. Tell me, where did you get the strength?
Yeah, well, first I have to say, I have to be honest.
Because it's so easy to stay in your comfort zone, you know. By the time you're 50, you've done things a certain way, you're used to things, you're in your own patterns and whatever.
Yeah, and I'm leaving all my friends and family.
You're like 15, 18 years away from retirement.
Yeah, and now I'm, I don't know how many kilometers that is, but 4,000 something kilometers away from my family and my friends. And then at the same time, I think 3 months after I moved here, Corona started.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, I couldn't even see my family and friends other than over, you know, Teams or Zoom or whatever we were using at the time. So, yeah, very, very challenging. So
That must have been a humbling experience during Corona as well.
It was. It was tough. But I have a belief that I was scared. I'm not going to tell anybody that I didn't have fear. But courage and fear are not mutually exclusive. They can exist. And it's okay to be afraid as long as that fear...
Because people always think that when you're courageous, you're unafraid.
Exactly.
But it's not true.
And that's not true.
No.
That's not true at all. Sometimes, you know, there's things worse than going to take a new job in a place you've never been to. I mean, there's... And I knew that after losing my son. To me, that was the most devastating thing that could have happened to me. So I figured I had nothing to lose by really doing something completely different. My mom thought I was crazy. I mean, I think she considered like mental assessment, like how could you do something like that? But I also understood that there was more for me. and I was going to try this path, I believe I would have regretted it if I did not try it. And so now I have, and I've met you, Nancy. I mean, so many wonderful things have come out of me being here.
And you're living together with a Dutch guy.
Yes, yes, yes.
Who would have thought that?
I certainly did not. Yeah. I did not.
Let's call the people in Naperville.
Exactly.
So, but listen, you're here. Corona is, you know, all over the place. You're here a couple of months. You have to establish yourself. You've got to rock this new role, find a network. How do you even go about it?
Yeah.
Because it wasn't easy. It's like I'm saying, you're in a new role, never existed. Corona breaks out.
Yeah.
You've got to have some lessons that you learned from that period that you want to share with us.
Yeah. One of the big things is, and I just read this in a book, by one of our Olympian stars on the soccer team. Her name is, I think it's Abby Wambach. I don't think I'm pronouncing her name right. But I was grateful, but I was also ambitious. And so I think sometimes we think that, I don't really deserve this. And
it was,
you know,
waiting for me.
It was, you know, I was super grateful for it, but I said, you know what? I'm going to make the most out of this opportunity. Mm-hmm. Microsoft really... You know, they took a chance on me as well when I think about that. But I checked my ego at the door. I was not, you know, arrogant or anything like that. Hey, I'm coming from Corp or coming from the U.S. and this is an American company. I came in ready to learn, but I also came in knowing that I had a lot to give. So I was grateful for the opportunity. I was open to my colleagues, but I also said, laid it on the table. This is what I have to give.
But
I have
this experience. Breaking.
Yeah, it's rule
Kim,
breaking.
Because
sure.
It doesn't happen a lot. It happens the other way around, where people go to the States and they conquer the States.
Exactly.
And normally people from the States don't want to really come and live here, and especially not black women that I know. Not a lot, but still.
Yeah.
You did it.
Yeah, I did it. Now, I have to say, I did do my research. And I knew that there was a black community here, and also a black community ready to support me. You know,
I've given you some Surinamese tips, right?
Yes, you have.
Some catering tips.
Yes, you have. And I'll
get some good food.
Lots of good food here. Lots of good food, but lots of good people. And my coworkers at Microsoft were so helpful when I could not see my family. And actually, my grandmother passed away the summer of 2020. So when Corona started, and I could not go to the funeral because at that point they had put a blocker in, right? You couldn't travel from Europe to the U.S. unless there was like a major emergency, but not for a funeral. So my team was so helpful. They let me take the day off, no questions asked. You know, when I would, and of course I was upset, they would comfort me. I just had a great team of people around me, and I had a diverse team too. I'm going to really talk about diversity because I think that's key.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. So,
were you able to choose the people in your team? And
not initially, but that was okay. So I will say that I was a little, taken aback is probably the first word because that comes to mind, because when my first meeting at Microsoft, I walked in. At Microsoft Netherlands, I walked in and I looked around and I looked because it was a hybrid meeting. There were some people on a Teams call and there were some people in the room. And there were 11 white guys and me.
That must have been shocking.
It was quite shocking. I must say, because I had not had that experience. If I had had that experience, it had been a very long time.
So you're telling me you never felt disadvantaged working for Microsoft in the U.S.?
Like, no. I'm not saying I didn't feel disadvantaged, but I've never been in a room before like that where I was the only person of color and the only woman in the room.
So this is very Dutch.
Very Dutch, yeah. And I believe that I'm here for a reason. One of those reasons is to point things like that out to Microsoft Netherlands. And they are now quite focused on D&I. I think the talk that I did at Amplify Her, I've talked a lot about that with my coworkers. And they actually, I should tell you this, in the time, I think it was the same day of Amplify Her, we had one of our executive members, so someone who reports to the board at Microsoft. He was speaking at Microsoft Netherlands, and a black woman, one of the only other ones there, she's from France, got up because he was kind of patting himself on the back for the great diversity and inclusion work we've done at Microsoft. And she got up and said, you know what? I don't see many people. I wasn't there, but she said, I don't see many people in this room that look like me.
Because he was saying,
how great and diverse and inclusive we were. And she got up in front. I really, my hat goes off to her because that took a lot of courage to do that. And she's an early in career professional. Mm-hmm. And she told him, looked him in the eye and said, I think we have a long way to go with diversity and inclusion. Certainly we've made some progress, but not enough. So that was a catalyst, I think, in addition to some of the things I've been doing and others like me have been doing, that was a catalyst for Microsoft Netherlands to say, you know what, it is time for us to make a change. We've got to make a difference.
So tell me about the stuff that you've been doing. Can you give a couple of examples of how you've been working towards more diverse teams within Microsoft?
Yeah, well, one of the things is now I'm a manager of people. The role that I came here to take has now is the first person in the company, but now there's over 300 people in that role. So, and I am a manager with a team of people like that on my, you know, on my team that are reporting to me. And so I make sure that number one, when we're hiring, we have a diverse slate of candidates. And number two, not just me, we have a diverse set of interviewers. I believe that hiring managers, especially, you know, people, you know, maybe within our subsidiaries, not necessarily executive management, but that middle management has a role to play to make sure that they are looking at a diverse group of candidates as they hire. And that's one big thing that I've really focused on since I've been here. The other thing is using the resources that we have. So I'm a part of a group called Blacks at Microsoft, and we even had Nancy come and speak to us last year about branding. And so that group finds ways to not only have people who are in that community to, you know, get information about how to grow themselves professionally or what career opportunities are available at Microsoft, but they also include allies in that.
I love speaking for that group because I expected it only to have black people, but it was not. It was Asian, white men, everybody.
Yes.
Everybody was part of Blacks at Microsoft.
Yes.
So it basically meant everybody that wanted to be an ally for black people at Microsoft joined Black at Microsoft.
That's
so
right.
It wasn't like an exclusive black people group.
That
everybody
defeats
was in
diversity,
it.
Right?
That defeats the purpose. But people don't look at it like that from the outside.
Yeah.
So that needs to be more visible.
Yeah.
So you're saying you became a manager, which is a big role within Microsoft. And you know, and it's something that is a leadership role.
Yeah.
So, you know, have you thought about the kind of leader that you want to be? Because I do think that if we're breaking rules and we're, you know, talking to rule breakers, they're showing something that's never been shown before. So if you look at yourself into this leadership role, what do you want to do differently? Or are there leaders that inspired you to become like them because they really were rule breakers or they changed the way that we managed people?
Yeah, so I think different times in my life, different people have inspired me. I'll talk about what's inspiring me right now. I am listening. Her name is Brené Brown. She also has a podcast, if you know Brené Brown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Power of Vulnerability.
Yes, The Power of Vulnerability. And I think that, to me, if you focus on that as a leader, you will open up so many doors, not necessarily for yourself, although typically, that's what happens, right? Because you reap what you sow. But you open it up for so many. And when I say doors, I mean mental doors. I mean, you know, actual positions for roles. I mean, getting people to think creatively about what else they can do to have an impact for themselves and on society. So I think that's different. That's different for most people. And if you talk to a lot of men who are leaders, vulnerability is not something that typically comes
up. So how does it show up in you? How do you show it?
I tell people when I make mistakes. I share that all the time with my team. You know, I tell people, you know, that it's tough sometimes to come to work, especially like just recently was the 7th anniversary of my son's passing, January 16th. And it's hard to show up.
I get it.
Yeah, to deal with that. So I tell people when I'm not at my best, I'm honest and open about that. And that's what's expected. Being vulnerable is being brave, you know? That's because most of us don't want to show our emotion. But what I learned as a leader too is that showing emotion helps people to relate to you, helps people to open up to you, helps people to trust you. And you can't lead people who don't trust you.
No.
So I believe vulnerability leads to a lot of connections and deep connections that allow you to have impact on people's lives. And that's what I want to do. Positive impact.
Love this. Thank you so much, Kim. So we're coming towards the end, and I'm always asking everybody this question. What advice would you give your 18-year-old self?
That's a tough one. My 18-year-old self, I would say, be intentional with what you want to do for others. If you're intentional with how you want to help and impact others, then you will be fulfilled in your life and you will grow as a person and just really focus on being a better human every day. That's my focus right now. How can I do? And then one other piece of advice, the little things matter. I think so many times in life, we, especially when we start out young, we have these big grand ideas of all the things we want to do and all the people we want to meet and, you know, who we want to become. And really and truly, it's the little things that can have some of the biggest impact. You can change your habits with little changes every day. You can change people's lives with little things you do. I think the Amplify Her event that you did and me speaking at that event, that literally changed my life in so many ways. And people came up to me. It was 8 minutes, because you told me I can only do 8 minutes. Maybe it was 10 minutes. But
you spoke for 10. I told you wait, but you took more.
I tried not to. I was really trying. But people came up to me afterwards and they said, you know what? That was so powerful for me. And I can really take that now and apply it to my life. And it wasn't just me. There were many women there who the same thing that spoke and had a story to tell. That 10-minute story could have an impact, mine and others, on hundreds of people, thousands of people.
Yeah, that's true.
So
last question.
Yes.
What's your biggest ambition for the future?
Oh, boy. I would love to write a book.
Mm.
Yeah. I think that there's a lot. You've helped me to tell my story, to kind of put it in a small form. But I think there's so much more I want to share with people. And I really want to share about, you know, the vulnerability piece and spread the Brené Brown philosophy, but also relationships. I think that people focus so much on skills and, you know, how much project management skills do I have? How can I be, you know, this you know, super great leader or all these other things to me that come out of building a relationship. If you build a relationship with people, there's so much more that you can do, so much more you can offer. Just like I talk about vulnerability and trust, that leads to a strong, connected relationship. And you know, business is built on relationship. It really is.
I say that all the time.
Yes.
And this is why businesses need more women like you. Thank you very
Thank
much,
you.
Ms. Kim Fukui.
Thank you,
from
Nancy Polian.
Chicago, via Alabama, Montgomery, Alabama. It was great talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome.